This is Fight Back with Bob Fetrakis and Connie Goodell Newton on WCRS 98.3 102.1.
Broadcasting from the studios at 1021 East Broad Street, bringing you the controversial issues of the day. It's coming up on the June 7th anniversary of Griswold versus Connecticut, which has that fabled term made famous during the Clinton administration, zones of privacy. Yes, in 1966, it was decided that a married woman could buy contraceptives and use them. Despite a Connecticut law described as an every sperm is sacred, which said no artificial boundaries could be erected, so to speak, between the sperm and the egg, making Catholics like my cohort, Connie, very happy, at least when she was a good Catholic schoolgirl. That was struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. What do you think about that, Connie?
Well, I think it probably brought on the sexual revolution of the 70s. 1966, finally, when women and, men too had access to birth control.
But this is a married woman who goes in and buys contraceptive without her husband.
Well, it's probably a good thing if they didn't want to have children.
weren't you taught in Catholic school that every sperm is sacred and that the act of sex itself is inherently sinful, only redeemed by the possibility of procreation?
Well, I think I learned that from Monty Python, Bob.
What are the Catholic schools up to if they're not teaching?
I don't really remember anything from Catholic high school.
But that's longstanding Catholic doctrine that sex is worldly and inherently sinful. Unless there's the possibility of procreation.
Yeah. Yes, we were taught that in Catholic high school. I went to high school back in the 90s when they still taught sex education in high school. So we did learn that in our religion class, but we didn't learn that in sex ed because we actually got real sex ed when I was in high school, even though it was a Catholic high school. So they did actually teach us about contraceptive methods. And my mom was a nurse. She taught me how to put a condom on a banana. So, I actually had a very good I'd say a well-rounded sexual education when I was in high school, learning about contraceptive methods, but also learning about relationships and how to have respectful relationships. And that is something that I learned in Catholic high school that I think I definitely benefited from, how to respect people. And, I ultimately, didn't buy into the whole thing about having sex only in marriage, but I think I learned something about having respectful relationships when I was in high school.
So you weren't taught the new movement, abstinence only.
No. And, when I socialize with people in their early 20s, which I still do pretty frequently, it takes me a minute to remember that a lot of them, there's a generational gap between me being almost 30 and people in their early 20s, because they didn't have sex education when they're in high school. So you get people in their early 20s who don't know how to prevent STDs and, who have very immature views on sexual relationships.
Come now, Connie, they know how to prevent it. Don't have sex.
Yeah, I guess you can just, keep your pants on. Do it with your pants on. Just a little kissing and grinding or something. But
Connie has now endorsed what they used to call dry humping as safe sex, along with sexting and phone sex, which are all forms of theoretically safe sex.
Yeah, and hand jobs, too. I definitely promote hand jobs for people of all genders. The great thing about it is that it doesn't matter what sex you or your partner is. A hand job is available to everybody.
Okay, the words of Connie Goodell Newton. Well, but you have problems with this right to privacy.
Well, yeah. So Griswold v. Connecticut, used the right to privacy to allow a married woman to get contraceptive. And then that was actually the precursor to Roe v. Wade, which legalized abortion. And that was also premised on the right to privacy. Furthermore, Lawrence v. Texas in 2003, so that's a pretty late case, that struck down sodomy laws. It said that the state had no business basically regulating what two consenting adults were doing in the privacy of their own home. So it basically outlawed discriminatory laws against gays and lesbians. That was also
which were actually
right
overturned Hardwick, the Georgia case, which a person was sent to prison, a male, for having homosexual sex.
Right. So I guess I'd say that that I do take issue a little bit about premising these rights to sexual freedoms on the right to privacy. How is that? I mean, I guess it's kind of derived from the Constitution. It's derived from the right to privacy. But historically, the right to privacy, it was the same right that allowed domestic violence and prevented the state from intervening in cases of domestic violence. So it's basically almost comparing abortion and gay sex to domestic violence, which is something as a feminist and somebody in the LGBT community that, I'm not really completely comfortable with. So I would say, that there's also a liberty interest in being able to have control over your, reproductive freedoms, being able to have birth control or abortion if it's necessary, or, engaging in different kinds of sexual conduct when it's between consenting adults. I think there's a liberty interest there and an interest in self-determination. I think a lot of women are kept out of politics, maybe because they have children and it's so much work to raise children, that it really is disempowering to women. So, I think, in order for women to be political equals, that they need to, be able to have that right to self-determination that you think of when you think of our constitutional rights.
Well, when I think of self-determination and integrating women, I think of decent health care. I think of the European and Scandinavian countries that, often will give you 2 to 5 years maternity or paternity leave, where dads get to stay at home when the kid's 2 and 3 years old, and the state pays for it. I mean, one of the amazing things is how little people in the U.S. understand the types of welfare systems that are really inclusive, that want women participation, as in Sweden, that are done through legislation. And they spend a lot of money creating a daycare system. France has another great early childhood development system where they actually pay parents. They pay families to stay together, so it's not a woman's responsibility. Recently, the census data indicated that only 20% of households are married families with kids. What used to be the majority in the 1950s is now a distinct minority. And part of that, if we had a system where if a couple, you had a child and you wanted to live with or marry that person, the state would in fact subsidize you, see that as pro-family policy, instead of making your husband, if he loses his job, flee the household in order for you to get welfare. Is that they pay money if you take your kid in and have health care checkups. In our system, it's all backloaded. We wait till they're 18 and spend $35,000 a year locking them up after we've forced them to live in dysfunctional families, destroyed by the economy, the jobs moved overseas, harassed by the police, living in poverty. So instead of creating stable families and making it easy for women to enter into politics, because we got a great, great system of early childhood development and other forms of child care, we don't do that here.
Right. Yeah, my mother lives in France, and I spent a considerable amount of time in France over the past 12 years. And they do have a great daycare system. It's called Creche, where children basically, it's open to all children, I think, regardless of income level. They have community daycare centers where everybody in the neighborhood brings their children. Just like public schools.
These studies, the average French daycare worker is supposed to have a master's degree in child development.
Yeah, and this provides jobs for people.
Livable wages.
It provides good jobs for people doing child care, and they're, you know, educated in how to deal with children. France also has a pretty high rate, I'd say, of couples who choose to have children together and remain unmarried. They decide not to get married sometimes. I think they really view marriage as something that, you know, is the state's role is separate from, like, your church's role. So you could get married, you know, within your church. If you didn't want to get married in your church, you could live together and have a domestic partnership, you know, as a straight couple. And that's something I really wish the United States would adopt. And
or like Canada, if you were gay, you're allowed to be married.
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, so I think having options for people would really do a lot to promote our liberty interests as Americans that we are supposed to have coming out of the Constitution. And indeed, Bob, there is paternity leave, maternity and paternity leave for parents. My mother tells me, you know, having worked in France, that, you know, the office jobs and the, you know, the employment situation there is competitive. And so not everyone chooses to take the paternity leave that they're given, especially, you know, especially the men may choose not to take that. But it is available to them. And I think, you know, with the European Union laws, which promote the equality of the genders, it's becoming more and more common for men to take parental leave as well. So, yeah, I definitely think that is a good direction to move towards employing people, you know, by having these, you know, daycare centers available to people and allowing parents to be parents and not have to, you know, leave the home while their children are very young.
So when we look at the history and development in the United States, it seems like if Roe versus Wade gets struck down, sorry, been modified by Webster on viability, a lot of it will be a return to when the state decides who can have sex and in what positions. Because a lot of the things, if you think about Griswold versus Connecticut, you had at least 36 states with so-called blue laws. That is, the only legal state or the only legal situation for sex in many of these states was married couple, missionary position, and if it was a Catholic-influenced state, a woman not enjoying it.
Was that part of the law, Bob?
No, it was kind of a cultural thing, Connie.
It was kind of implied, I think. So Roe versus Wade has been kind of chipped away at by Webster and other cases. And so I guess my question that I would pose to you is, what does that do in general to our right to privacy? And what has happened to our right to privacy through the years? You know, recently we've had the Patriot Act. I think we have some things to talk about there with the Patriot Act. But it seems like, you know, our rights as Americans are being chipped away at, of every American. You know.
And again, you'll get these incredibly important issues, and the news gives him such little coverage. But I'll get back to that point.
This is Fight Back with Bob Fitrakis and Connie Goodell Newton on WCRS 98.3, 102.1.
Take for example last week with the widely reported but not detailed reporting of an auto pin signing the renew of the Patriot Act. First, regardless of your ideological or political persuasion, Rand Paul, the libertarian Republican senator who tried to tie up the renewal of the Patriot Act with parliamentary maneuvers and almost succeeded, should be given much credit. It's people like Dennis Kucinich, who are progressive, and Rand Paul, who understand the implications of the security industrial complex in the same way I think George Orwell understood it in 1984. Right? And first of all, the Patriot Act was rushed through in the aftermath of 9/11. People were scared. It was sitting there on the shelf. It gives virtually unlimited rights to spy on American citizens without probable cause, embodied in the Fourth Amendment.
Right. Basically, in order to spy on Americans, all they have to do is suspect them of terrorism. Is that about right?
Yeah, it's
basically, if you're suspected of terrorism, which I mean, I could basically suspect anybody. And I think it has really been used against Muslim Americans, Arab Americans, because
it justifies racial and ethnic profiling,
basically. Let's see. Oh, there's somebody who looks suspicious. They have dark skin. Let's start spying on them.
But the reality, if we really look at terrorists, the people I would profile are white Anglo-Saxon Protestants.
Mm-hmm.
And I say this, you know, as a Greek American. But look, the people that have terrorized our country are Klan members. Historically, they're our oldest indigenous terrorist group. Those have primarily been white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. They've hated Catholics. They've hated Eastern Orthodox people from Eastern Europe. They've hated blacks. They've hated everyone but white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. So if you want the oldest terrorist group, you got to go with the WASP and the Bush family, right? Because they've terrorized more people than anyone. I wrote an article just recently saying, you've got NATO, right? You've got NATO, a defensive alliance in Europe set up to stop the old Soviet empire, which isn't around anymore. Now you have NATO trying to overthrow the government of Libya, and it started out as enforcing a no-fly zone to protect Arab civilians. This is what I'm arguing, if you think about Arab civilians. The Bush family has killed more Arab civilians than anybody on Earth in the history of the planet. If we go back, we got to throw Clinton in there because he continued with the policy in the same way Obama is, but the Bush family in the first Gulf War, over a million Arabs died in Iraq. We systematically violated every known international law. We bombed their water. We bombed their sewage, which is illegal under the Geneva Convention, illegal. And then we allowed that dirty, filthy water to contaminate the population. And what did we do? We then forbade the importation of food and medical supplies. So 500,000 children died. And then Madeleine Albright told Leslie Stahl of CBS News that it was worth the price. 500,000 Arab kids.
Yeah, it wasn't
killed.
Her kids.
Exactly.
It wasn't the white kids. You know?
And then we go after Iraq under George W. Bush. They don't have weapons of mass destruction. Two-thirds of the country is under a no-fly zone. They're no threat to the United States because we're attacked by their arch enemy, the pan-Islamic bin Laden and al-Qaeda group. So because their arch enemy attacks us, we go over, and John Hopkins has suggested we've killed at least 655,000 civilians there because of our invasion. We went in, we dissolved their army, we dissolved their police, we failed to guard the weapons depots as required by law, hence different ethnic groups came in, grabbed weapons, and killed each other. So now what are we doing? Here we are saying, boy, we really care about Arab civilians. We've got to stop Gaddafi from killing Arab civilians.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole dialogue is very problematic. Basically, what I've noticed about this, about violence, and, you know, violence is violence, is that when it's perpetrated by a state, it's called warfare. And when it's perpetrated by somebody who isn't a state, then it's called terrorism. And basically, you know, it's like, you know, the United States as a state, you know, can do, you know, way, way worse stuff than, you know, the people who bombed 9/11, you know, on 9/11,
sure,
the towers. You know, that was an isolated incident, and it really, you know, scared a lot of people that there might be more attacks and everything. But whoa, the, you know, whoop ass that we pulled out after that, you know, was
in comparison, it was
much worse. And it's that's not like considered terrorism, because like in the dialogue, it's not considered terrorism or called terrorism because it is, you know, performed by a state entity and not independent actors.
But one of the key concepts of so-called just war and international law and war is proportionality, right? They killed 3,000, hence we can kill 750,000. That is not proportionate. How is that just that 750,000 Arabs in Iraq die because their arch enemy in Al-Qaeda killed 3,000 people in one instant? It must be proportionate.
Yeah. Any more on that?
On that, yeah. I'm thinking is, yeah, that, well, like, war is killing wholesale. Murder is killing retail.
Yes.
Hence, and the more powerful you are, right, historically, it's been accepted that those are the most powerful.
And the least, or those the less that, likely you are to be held accountable, the more people you kill.
Right, exactly.
It's like, you know, usually
the war crimes are for the people that lose the wars, not the ones that win.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's something that, you know, one criticism of, you know, the UN and the war crimes tribunals has been that, you know, they kind of pick who they're going to prosecute. They don't necessarily do it equally. You know, I'm for war crimes tribunals. I think it's a good idea to hold people accountable when they commit war crimes and violations. But unfortunately, it is, you know, meted out kind of selectively. So that, you know, it's not a perfect system, but it's still evolving. International law, international criminal law is still evolving and developing. So I think that that it has a lot of potential to hopefully deter war crimes by holding people accountable. And if, you know, at least to send a message that certain kinds of violence like genocide and exterminations are not going to be tolerated. Now, on the other hand, unfortunately, it seems that we have unprosecuted war criminals in the United States. So it's really, you know, the ICC leaves it up to...
And I'm on the record, including George W. Bush there. And I'm wondering is, you know, I believe that NATO has overstepped its bounds. It's one thing to want to protect civilians and have a no-fly zone. It's another thing when suddenly you decide that you can jack 144 tons of gold that Libya has in its central bank. I believe if there wasn't oil and 144 tons of gold in the central state bank that's not privatized in Libya, that we would care less what Gaddafi did to any of his civilians. We would stand by as we did in Rwanda while a million people died because it wasn't oil-rich Rwanda. I don't believe for a second that President Obama cares about the civilians of Libya. I think if he cared about liberation of people and relieving them from authoritarianism, he would overthrow the government of Saudi Arabia, an oppressive, brutal 12th century republic.
All right. Well, back to the topics of liberty. There is an event coming up, the World Naked Bike Ride, on June 11th at 11:59.
And why can't President Obama come out in support of the World Naked Bike Ride?
Right. So, I mean, I think, yeah, just back to the topic of liberty, I think that's a great chance to, you know, get together with your cohorts and ride bikes through Columbus, through the capital city, and you know, promote your own interests in liberty and self-determination.
And what about those zones of privacy that may be exposed?
Well, I think since you're in public, you're not protected by the right to privacy. So, unfortunately, if anybody is taking pictures and putting them up on Facebook, that could be a problem for some people.
And if you want to be a future congressperson, then who knows what's going to happen? Because I think it wasn't a Congressman Wiener who claimed somebody hacked his Twitter account.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that sounds like a pretty obvious prank. I mean, his name is Wiener, after all, right? I mean, it was a, I think it was a picture of his, like, of somebody's bulging underpants. I don't think it was even necessarily his. It was like a on the word Wiener, right?
But what if we got to call up the Free Press or into this show, Fight Back with Connie and Bob, and said somebody has hacked Connie's account. She's naked on a bike riding through Columbus. What would I do?
We would say, that's actually Connie, and it's a publicity stunt so that she can get more votes in the next election.
Listen to WCRS.
Yes.
All right. So then when one more time, when's the World Naked Bike Ride?
Yeah. Well, I suppose it'll be happening all over the world, but in Columbus, Ohio, it will be meeting at the Third Hand Bike Co-op at 11:59 on Saturday the 11th. And riders are encouraged to, you know, wear as little as they feel comfortable with. You know, could be a bikini, or, you know, you could be relatively covered up or something. But the idea is really to, you know, express your individuality. So it will be taking off and leaving from the Third Hand Bike Co-op on East 5th Avenue. It's 174 East 5th Avenue in Columbus. And we, or they, will be riding around the neighborhood and and then regrouping back there at the end for a party. So I think it is a good opportunity to, you know, bike and feel free.
As an investigative reporter, it's incumbent on me to ask you, why do they call it the Third Hand Bike Co-op? Does that have anything to do with eclectic sexual proclivities? The Third Hand?
The Third Hand, I think, comes from the idea of recycling bikes over and over again. So the Third Hand Bike Co-op, they accept donations, and then they teach people to fix bikes, and they actually give a lot of bikes to children in the community. They have a lot of $5 bikes right now for children's bikes.
Probably a terrorist group under the Patriot Act.
Yeah, the neighborhood kids.
Giving away free bikes, yes. Huh? Well, must be socialist or anarchist.
The bike co-op could be a terrorist organization, or the neighborhood kids riding their bikes could be a terrorist organization under the Patriot Act. Who knows? You know, it's a pretty, I guess, a liberal definition.
Particularly if they ride their bikes chasing the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile, which I heard is slated to come back to Columbus, Ohio. And I bet that they may have to go up against the Goodell Newton Third Hand Bike Brigade that may chase down the Wienermobile.
Right. So, Fight Back, we're bringing you news and updates and political analysis on the right to privacy, Lawrence v. Texas, Roe v. Wade. And June 7th is the anniversary of Griswold v. Connecticut, the case that allowed women to get birth control. This has been Fight Back with Bob Fitrakis and Connie Goodell Newton on WCRS 98.3, 102.1.